This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Malcolm Holine, Conference of Presidents, Major American Jewish Organizations, returns from overseas, from Israel. However, we have Israel on the line. Our reporter from I-24 News to help us understand the moving story of the Hamas threat, Hezbollah threat, the Syria threat, the Iran threat, and then there is generally the world's economy. Malcolm, you have a question for Mike. Welcome, Mike Wagenheim.
Well, yes, it's good to have you back again and to be on with you. While I was in Israel, the president, the vice president, Secretary Rubio twice, Witkoff and Jared all came. How do you see right now the coordination in terms of Middle East policy? Is there jockeying for preeminence? Is there a division of labor that you see in terms of the implementation of the peace agreements that were, and with Witkoff scheduled to leave? How will that change?
Yeah, I don't think there's a jockeying for preeminence. I think to the Trump administration's credit, I think ego have largely been put aside, and all that internal palace talk early on about Witkoff and Rubio and their rivalry and struggle for power, I think, has been largely cast aside, and we haven't heard anything of that for quite some time now. I think it just came about because of the uniqueness of the setup and how the circumstances had changed so quickly. But in any case, I think it is more of a division of labor. I think Witkoff and Kushner have emerged as the detail men, with their eye on the minor but critical provisions of the peace plan, keeping everything in check, keeping everything going forward. But the bigger picture stuff has been left to the likes of Secretary Rubio and Vice President Vance and so on and so forth. So there has been that kind of division. The one thing that's really united everybody in the Trump administration is that there really still is not a plan B. Everything must be kept on track, that Trump et al. Are willing to give a lot of latitude here in order to keep the ceasefire intact, latitude to Hamas, latitude to Israel, but making sure that any violations of the ceasefire are kept in check, kept in proportion, and making sure that there is still a viable path forward to phase number two. So everybody's playing their part right now and trying to at least keep that forward progress going.
Mike, it's October 2025. Are we going to be having the same conversation in October 2026? Violations, but they're keeping moving.
Well, God willing, no, but at least there was a realistic understanding of the situation. When we think in terms of ceasefires and wars and even past ceasefires vis-a-vis Israel and Hamas, we think that's it. Midnight strikes or whatever the time strikes, and that's the end of hostilities. And that's it. There's no more firing. Anything is looked upon as a grave, grave violation. And I think there was a realism at this point because the situation is so complicated, because there is still a lengthy path forward in the peace plan, that the ceasefire was not the be-all, end-all, but seemingly a starting point to a larger plan here. There was a realistic outlook that, okay, we know there's going to be violations here. We know Hamas is not going to play by all the rules. What we're not going to do is throw it all away simply because everybody's not sticking to the letter or the spirit of the agreement. So, God, I hope we're not talking about this in October 2026, but I don't think the fact that there were violations right off the bat and some despicable ones by Hamas, like the fakery of the recovery of the hostage, I don't necessarily think that's an indication in and of itself that this plan cannot work. There are other reasons the plan might not work, but I don't think that's chief among them.
Malcolm,
when you see this situation in Washington, is there the concern that I heard in the Middle East about the role of Qatar and Turkey enshrining their roles in Gaza, expanding their roles in Gaza and in Syria, and generally the president's very generous comments about the world leaders, describing the people, the leaders of Qatar, which, as you know, in the other Gulf states is viewed with great concern, as it is in Israel.
It's a tough spot for Israel right now, but it's an own goal, because for such a long time, there was no plan. There was no day after scenario put forward for many reasons. We can have a separate discussion about that. But there simply was never a plan put on the table about who's going to run Gaza the day after. So what happens? Somebody else makes that plan. And in this case, it's the American president who has strong ties to Erdogan in Turkey, who has strong ties to the Qataris. And so somebody else came along and set the ground rules. Of course, Israel can argue its case, but it has much less leverage now and much less say so. And what would have been a red line many months ago suddenly becomes a squiggly line. And it's in many cases, in many ways, it's not up to the Israelis at this point in time, although they can continue to press their case, though it may fall on deaf ears here at the White House.
I'm told Doha was a large contributor, if not the contributor, to Hamas before the war. Is Doha continuing to fund Hamas, and are they paying any penalty for their betrayal?
It's unclear at this point. And Hamas, listen, they're struggling financially for many reasons at this point. Money that comes into Gaza came in with the consent of Israel. Again, we could have a completely separate, lengthy discussion about whether that was a smart move, whether Israel would do that again if it knew what was coming. It's a separate discussion. But I don't see Qatar at this point funding Hamas, because there really isn't a whole lot to fund at this part. They're not paying salaries at this point in time. They want Hamas to wind down operations to a large extent. I can't get inside the Qatari mind, nor would I want to, in terms of whether they feel enough pressure from the Americans to push push Hamas into completely disarming and giving up their weapons on a permanent basis. But the fact is, right now, the Qataris also have skin in this game. They don't want to run afoul of Trump. And so if Trump sees that they're also playing a double game, then it creates tension there as well. I don't think Trump, as much as he gives lip service to the Qataris, as much as he gives lip service to Erdogan, he doesn't want to be played for a fool by anybody right now. And he doesn't want anybody upsetting what could be a monumental presidency-defining achievement here. So I think everybody is trying to be, to the extent that they can, on their best behavior right now.
We have less than a minute, Malcolm.
Yeah, quick question about sanctions on Syria and sanctions on Iran. Is there a mood in Congress to really move that ahead? Will we see that the implementation like the FATF did against Iran?
Oh, there's always sanctions packages going around in Congress regarding Iran. And I think the push will only move forward now, especially after the UN snapback sanctions were kicked in. You want to talk about maximum pressure, now's the time. In terms of Syria, of course, it's the opposite way. There's a move in Congress, and I think it'll be done soon, to completely lift the sanctions on Syria that were imposed under the Assad regime. I don't think there's much appetite at this point even for a phased lifting of those sanctions. I think it's going to be done fairly quickly in the near future if Congress ever returns to work.
I-24 is news for us, news for you. The man we count on, Mike Waggenheim, on a moving story, to say the least. Malcolm Honlein, Conference of Presidents, Major American Jewish Organizations.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.